Welcome back to Current State. It's Monday here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We could learn more tonight as to how streetlights get paid for in the city of Lansing. This is an ongoing discussion. The city council is scheduled to take up a resolution tonight that would increase the Lansing Board of Water and Light's annual payment to the city. And that this proposal comes after cuts to the city's general fund that used to pay for that. So we may know more about that. We should know more about that tomorrow morning at this time. Later on in the program, we're going to speak with Joe McGill. Joe works for the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and a mission of his is to preserve former slave dwellings. Slave dwellings, cabins, other structures are scattered throughout mostly the southern part of the United States. And Joe makes it a habit to spend the night in former slave dwellings in an attempt to generate support for their preservation. Okay, and in a few minutes, we're going to talk with Joe, who spent the night at a former slave dwelling in Maryland. He comes up in just a little bit. Rob Fowler of the Small Business Association of Michigan. More on Obamacare from Rob Fowler coming up. At the top of the show, Republicans have left Mackinac Island after their biennial leadership conference, which took place over the weekend. The Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta was there, and he joins us to bring us up to date on everything that happened.
Well, I'd like to, Mark, but there's a rule about Mackinac conventions, and that's what happens on Mackinac stays on Mackinac. But thanks for inviting me.
That's exactly where we want to go with this segment. We want to know what happened. Was there much tension between the establishment wing of the GOP and the Tea Party? And was any of that tension visible?
Well, yes. Although the Tea Party, sort of there was this anticipation that there might be a Tea Party insurgency, there and present and directed at Governor Snyder and specifically at the effort to replace Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly on the ticket next year.
Yes.
With a Tea Partier. But there just weren't that many there, and they were still pretty effectively contained. But you're sort of hearing a subtle or maybe not so subtle shift in messaging from the establishment wing of the Republican Party. And I say it's the establishment saying, this is our party and we want it back. The Tea Party has been going after, Rick Snyder and some other establishment Republicans, saying that they're not really Republicans because they don't adhere to conservative principles. They don't adhere to the Republican platform, things like that. And there were a lot of variations on a theme of, if you want to call someone a rhino, a Republican in name only, mm-hmm. a rhino is someone who, after the fight is over and you've won or you've lost, that you pick up your marbles and you go home because you're not happy with the result.
Mm-hmm.
And they say so what they're saying is the Tea Partiers are in so many words is that Tea Partiers who say that they're not going to vote for Governor Snyder next year because he's not sufficiently conservative, who they might not support the ticket if they can't get Brian Kelly off it and replaced with one of their own, that they're not going to participate, that they're the ones who are not the real Republicans. And that's definitely a different form of pushback on that.
Was Wes Nakagiri at the conference?
He was there, although interestingly, he tried to arrange a get-together in Mackinac City on the other side of the Straits of Mackinac from the island. And somehow, mysteriously, the event got canceled, that there were, permitting issues that showed up late in the game.
What was that all about?
I don't know, but it's kind of interesting that apparently, it's pretty difficult to rent a room in Mackinac City but maybe that's just for some people.
Well, let's talk about these straw polls, which really generated an awful lot of attention yesterday. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly was the notable winner in the straw poll for Lieutenant Governor.
86%, no surprise, especially since, really this is a conference of the Republican establishment. Other people, other elements of the party will come into it, but it's on Mackinac Island at the Grand Hotel. It's expensive to get there. It's expensive to stay there. And so, just simply
economics,
yeah. You know, just keeps a lot of people away. But I don't think it's any surprise that the vast majority of the party does support Brian Kelly and quite frankly doesn't really doubt his conservative credentials. Has he, you know, strayed from that line? Yes. I mean, you know, that he was basically the author and chief advocate of the autism insurance mandate, you know, just to name one. But no one really doubts that
– Supported, you know, Medicaid expansion.
He supported the Medicaid expansion, you know, but you know, other than that, that's, you know, pretty – not the autism mandate, but you know, there are a lot of business groups that were along with that too, and he's considered to be a pretty reliable pro-business Republican.
And the governor, in a statement yesterday, claimed that Brian Kelly is a conservative voice.
Oh, not just the governor,
in the administration.
I believe I was not aware of this before Mackinac Island, but one of the minor revelations to me is that conservative voice is apparently Brian Kelly's middle names.
Okay.
He is Brian, conservative voice, Kelly. Apparently his parents had plans for him because it was just like it was joined to his name, I think, every time it got mentioned.
How much of that is politics, though, and how much of that
is Mark, it's
really
a politics conference.
Born out by the record.
I mean, this is true in both the Republican and the Democratic coalitions. I mean, it depends on your, in this case, you know, what your definition of conservative is and where do you draw the lines about whether one is a conservative or not. Now, just to conjure up an example, if you are a social conservative, if that's why you're part of the Republican Party and you came in because you want marriage to be defined in law as one man and one woman, that you are ardently anti-abortion, a Republican who's not with you on that because, you know, that they want less government regulation and low taxes – you know, is that going to be sufficiently Republican for you?
It depends on the litmus test.
It depends on what, you know, your particular issues are, right, and what is it that brings you into the coalition that will decide whether or not you think someone is sufficiently, you know, Republican or whatever it is that you're looking for.
Rand Paul of Kentucky, who is something of a rock star with an awful lot of Republicans, ended mm-hmm. up winning a presidential straw poll. What's the takeaway from that?
Well, I mean, we should point out that you know, straw polls by their nature, they're not scientific. They're not an accurate measure of Republican of public opinion. But and in this case, about a third of the participants actually cast a ballot in the straw poll. But they are a signal of where the activists, you know, the people who are going to do all the early work in a campaign are headed. And certainly Rand Paul got, you know, points for showing up and speaking to this group. But he is a rock star largely because of the filibuster about in the Senate about the administration's use of drones. And people just remember that, you know, he stood up and spoke, you know, for hours and hours and hours and effectively, you know, and to them, you know, that's an accomplishment. The second place winner, although pretty far back, 36% for Paul, Chris Christie got 16% of the votes. And what I was told, though, is that what that suggests is what Republicans are looking for in this cycle, at least, you know, Michigan Republicans who are going to get out and work in the early stages of a presidential campaign, are looking for someone with passion that they believe is principled and honest about what they're doing. And, you know, I mean, Rand Paul and Chris Christie are both, you know, a little bit larger than life, colorful figures that, people are intrigued by. I mean, sort of in Rand Paul's case, one of the things that was interesting was he actually made some pretty big news up on Mackinac Island when he said that basically, you know, killing Obamacare is probably not in the cards, and that Republicans maybe ought to start looking at trying to improve it, you know, make it something more like what they'd want to see. And, you know, this is at the same time that members of Michigan's Republican congressional delegation are showing up to, you know, cheers and huzzas for their votes on the budget resolution to, defund Obamacare. And if they don't get that than, you know, threatening a government shutdown. By the way, the governors who were there were not happy about that at all. Scott Walker said it was a bad idea. Governor Snyder said that shutdown isn't good for anyone. But, you know, Rand Paul came up and said, you know, it's time to start compromising, not what you say at an event like that.
Well, do you think that comment might get a lot of ardent anti-Obamacare types, defund Obamacare types, to really reconsider their positions?
Oh, I don't know. That's a great question. You know, when it came time for his dinner address to this group, he mentioned it, but only because it was sort of gaining traction throughout the day. And I'm not sure that the people who were there, that it even really registered. It seemed like it was almost shoehorned in when he said, I'd like to defund Obamacare, but, you know, I would settle for making it better. And then he just kind of moved on. I don't know if it even registered. But the other thing too is, you know, when you're a politician and you actually, you know, people have faith in you, that does give you a certain amount of latitude to do things that the base might otherwise be skeptical of. I mean, I think it's a place that Rick Snyder certainly tried to go to with a whole lot of issues, the Medicaid expansion being the most recent one, but certainly the International Bridge in Detroit, road funding to name two others. And he just doesn't have the same cachet as a Rand Paul to pull that off.
Could Paul's comment also reduce his own support, though?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No,
yeah.
I absolutely. It is a risk. As a matter of fact, there are sort of two schools of thoughts about why he said that and, you know, and the when and the where. And one of them is that, you know, he just doesn't recognize that when you put yourself out there like that as a prospective presidential candidate, everything you say gets, you know, picked up, examined,
re-examined
and passed along. Or maybe, you know, Saturday is the slowest news day of the week. People aren't paying attention, that you're far away from Washington, D.C. and the media megaphone that's there. And, you know, maybe it's a nice, you know, quiet way to kind of roll out your position on that.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, could you say that there were other key Republicans attending here? Governor Bobby Jindal, you mentioned Scott Walker earlier, mm-hmm. Karl Rove.
And by the way, you know, we talked about people who are attending, that Bobby Jindal, out of like 500 and something people who voted, only got 7 votes in that straw poll. So, you know, that suggests something about the power of attending, you know, versus, you know, just the star cachet that you had.
Yeah, and Christie was not there at all either.
He
was the only other guy to finish in double digits. And Rand Paul had the keynoter on Saturday night. Mm-hmm. So you would think that
actually Rand Paul followed Bobby Jindal, who delivered a very well-received speech.
Yeah. Okay. Could you let's talk about the Senate race. Was there an describe the mood surrounding Terry Lynn Land's campaign? I mean, Justin Amash just a few days ago made it official. He's out. She would be up here.
It almost seems to be hers for the taking. I mean, it's, you know, the brass ring is almost, she's almost got it, but not quite that. People are still looking and wondering if someone else is going to jump in. Dr. Rob Steele from the Ann Arbor area, he ran against John Dingell a little while back and did respectably, and by respectably meant that he lost only in low double digits to the chairman and not high double digits. But so, you know, he's still out there. But I think that people are starting to sort of coalesce around the idea that it's going to be Terry Land, just wondering if there isn't someone else out there. And she was working the convention very hard. And I would say, you know, really, you know, acting almost like the nominee in waiting.
Very good. Good stuff. Rick Plute of the Michigan Public Radio Network, back from Mackinac Island, and what happens on the island stays on the island.
Well, the rest of it does.
The rest of it does. Thanks, Rick. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. Nearly 50,000 Michigan residents were diagnosed with chlamydia that's a sexually transmitted disease, in 2012. According to our next guest, the subject of sexual health remains shrouded in stigmatized myths. Janelle Marie of the STD Project wants to change the conversation surrounding STDs. The STD Project is a social movement and primarily a website geared toward eradicating misconceptions about STDs. Janelle, the website's founder, explained that she started the project because of a personal experience.
I started it because I am living with an STD. I'm living with genital herpes. I've had genital herpes for 14 years now. I was 16 years old when I contracted it. And it hasn't always been easy for me. And especially 14 years ago, there weren't any resources, really. There weren't websites out there talking about how to live with myself, what to think about being with an STD. And all of what I had heard about STDs was highly stigmatized, that people with STDs were certain kinds of people, and that meant that I was a bad person. So the intent behind the STD Project is to provide a safe space for people who are living with an STD, people who aren't certain if they've contracted an STD or not, to ask questions. Mm-hmm. So really to provide that additional resource on top of just the basic scientific information that you can find everywhere else on the internet or at a clinic, this provides that gray area.
A lot of people would say we live in a pretty sexually liberated age, a sexually aware age, relatively at least. Is stigmatization of people with STDs more common than some people might think?
Yeah, I think an easy way to describe it, and just when as a listener who's thinking about it, people aren't aware that people of all different walks of life, shapes and sizes, all different ethnicities, religious backgrounds, contract STDs every day.
Gay, straight.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter who you are and where you come from. And we see that every day on the website, that's the most frustrating part, is that people assume that those with an STD. So the short answer to your question is yes. The stigmatization is ripe and is still out there, and it makes it really difficult for those who do end up contracting an infection or disease, because oftentimes the infection itself is quite benign or is less problematic than the actual stigma and the emotional traumatization of contracting a highly stigmatized, a very taboo infection that you can't talk about. There's very little information out there. And there's all of these misconceptions and myths and assumptions about who you now are, what your character is supposed to be like, and this is supposed to define you as some sort of harlot or, you know, just a trashy individual and maybe a cheater or something along those lines.
Who though, indulges in this stigmatization? Where does that come from?
Sure. It just comes from a lack of education, quite honestly. It comes from a lack of thorough, comprehensive education, saying most people aren't aware of how prevalent STIs and STDs are because no one talks about it. So if no one talks about it, people aren't aware that their next-door neighbor is likely living with an infection. It's almost more the norm than it is the rarity. One in two people by the age of 25 will contract an infection. So one in two by the age of 25, so then that number gets higher as people get older. Just in HPV alone, the human papillomavirus, by the age of 50, 80% of all women will have contracted that infection at some point in their lifetime. 80%. Mm. So once you start to understand the numbers, and these are numbers reported by the Centers for Disease Control, Planned Parenthood Federation, there's a combination, the American Sexual Health Association also reports on these. So yeah, once you start to know that actually all sorts of people are encompassing this and that there's an inherent risk in all sexual activities, I think then it becomes more realistic that, oh, wow, this is an actual, a real something that people deal with, a real risk out there. It's not just mm-hmm. something that only certain kinds of people who sleep with all, you know, too many people or something like that encounter.
Your story is on your website, thestdproject.com. I imagine that's what makes your website quite a bit different from a lot of other resource sites on STDs.
Yeah, yeah. No one talks about it, especially not honestly with their picture attached. And I'm like the walking STD lady, and that's okay because for a long time I believed those things about me too. So now it took a while to overcome that, and I want everyone to know that you can be successful. You can be a wonderful individual. You can have a great sex life, a healthy sex life, and good relationships, and none of that has to inhibit that potential.
Tell us more about how having an STD impacted your life. Obviously, you contracted it. 16, did you say?
Yeah, 16.
16. You are now 30.
Yes.
You were barely half as old then as you are now. You have a much richer perspective on life than you did as a 16-year-old,
no doubt.
Talk to us about the last 14 years.
Sure. I was really naive, and I grew up in the country in a small southwest town or western Michigan town, and I had horses and sheep, and I'm a blonde white girl, was a cheerleader and was in theater and really did well in school. And I thought that when I became sexually active and was engaging and beginning to experiment as a 16-year-old teenager often does, it's quite common, not everyone does, but I thought that me being responsible and that incorporated taking birth control, using condoms. And I didn't even use condoms consistently because I started taking birth control. And I thought that was me being safe. The risk of sexually transmitted infections and diseases had not been taught to me. And some of that information was out for my taking, too, and I just didn't access it. I really thought that it was not something. I believed the stigma that was out there, that only certain kinds of people, a white Midwest girl, was not going to contract an infection. I was sleeping with quote-unquote clean people, that kind of thing. So when that happened to me, it was a huge shock. It's highly embarrassing, first of all, and scary, really. And my first thought was that I was never going to be able to date again. I would never have a relationship. My mother took me in when I got diagnosed, and in the car ride home, I don't remember this, she was telling me the story recently, at least when I launched the website, I guess, so that was a year and a half ago, that I just cried the entire way home saying no one would ever love me again, no one would ever want me, I was never going to be able to do anything anymore. And there was a period of time where I believed that, obviously, and I had a lot of trouble in peer relationships as a result. I told a couple of my best friends. They told everybody else. Consequently, high school is a tough time, as it is. And then couple that with a taboo sexually transmitted infection, and you can just imagine the struggle. But overall, I figured out at some point in time that I was an intelligent individual. I had dreams and aspirations, and I actually had all sorts of still dates and individuals interested in a relationship with me. And over time, I realized that that did not at all hinder any of those things, nor was an infection a defining characteristic. It actually was what I had was not who I was. So basically, it was a self-discovery, a lot of self-discovery to decide that I was going to kind of buck what I was hearing and become someone else or you know, kind of buck what everyone was saying about me and that that wasn't actually the truth.
What kind of impact do you think your website is having a year and a half into it now?
Yeah, you know, I hadn't anticipated. Actually, it took me this long. When I was around 17, 18, I wanted to help people, but I didn't know in what capacity or how that was going to turn out. And it took years later, 30 years old. I was 29 when I launched it because I felt that at 29, I finally was ready to come out and say I kind of came out in a way that similar to what someone who a sexual orientation or something would come out with. So I came out and I was ready to do it. And I finally thought that, okay, I'm ready to handle all of the negativity that's going to come slashing toward me because I want to be able to make it easier for someone else who's in my situation, who is a 16-year-old, 17, 18, whatever age. And I have had almost nothing but positivity and support in terms of all sorts of organizations saying, we love what you're doing, we want to support this, and we want to encourage this because we know that this is helping people. And the messages that I get, Mark, every day they pour in, email on top of email of people telling me their story stories. And I mean, in a sense, I'm really honored that they're willing to share this with me because it's so personal and so sensitive, but there's nowhere else for them to turn. No one else is going to say, you're okay, you're still beautiful and fantastic, and you're still going to have a relationship, you're still going to be loved, you still have all this potential, because it's just not out there. So yeah, it's just been phenomenal. It's really rewarding.
And what are your long-term hopes for this project?
My long-term hope is what we want to call, or what we at the STD Project call, sexual responsibility. So it's a new take on sexual health, or at least, I guess, not necessarily new, but our take on sexual health. Whereas a lot of sexual health, traditional sexual health educators will encourage, and we do, we talk about what safer sex means, safer sex, because all sexual activity includes some level of risk. So there's no such thing, aside from abstinence, of being 100% safe. So we talk about what safer sex means in a comprehensive safer sex approach, which has a couple of different steps, which includes barriers and includes getting tested, includes talking to your partner before engaging in sexual activities with them. However, a lot of people will find some of those steps too detailed. They will find them impractical. And so what we want to say is sexual responsibility then should be your priority. And being sexually responsible includes knowing what level of risk there is out there, understanding what the real risk is when you're engaging in sexual activities and being intimate with someone else, sharing your body at that level. Understanding that, knowing it, knowing how to negate those risks via safer sex practices, and then choosing as an individual what you want to incorporate.
Janelle Marie is the founder of the STDproject.com. Janelle, thanks for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. In parts of the United States, there are an unknown number of old dwellings that were once the homes of slaves. Our next guest has made it his mission to see as many of them preserved as he can. Joe McGill publicizes his quest by periodically spending the night in an old slave cabin. Mr. McGill is a program officer with the National Trust for Historic Preservation, although his slave dwelling project is strictly his own initiative. He's starting his day today at the site of a former slave dwelling in Old St. Mary's City, Maryland, where he spent the night and where he is ready to talk with us about his project via cell phone. Joseph McGill, welcome to Current State.
Welcome. Thank you for having me on this morning.
Sure. Describe for our listeners where you just spent the night.
I am in historic Old St. Mary's, Maryland, and I spent the night in a former slave cabin here on this site, and I was with Terry Brock. He spent the night here with me, and we were expecting more, but it was fine, just the two of us. We had good conversation talking about the local history here, the local history of this particular slave cabin that we stayed in last night, and it was just a continuation of what I do with this project. This was stay number 48, the second stay in the state of Maryland.
And just describe the space that you were sleeping in last night. Was it, how big was it? Was it a dirt floor, that kind of thing?
Well, it was a dirt floor, somewhat. It was, there were wooden planks on the floor on the other side of the opposite side of where we stayed. It's a duplex. There is dirt there. There is some work that needs to be done to the cabin to place the floor where we actually stayed. But we actually stayed on wooden planks, and I was elevated on a cot. Terry Brock was on padding and in a sleeping bag in the space. And in the space itself, there is a huge fireplace where I speculated that there was some cooking, a lot of cooking done, because the fireplace is huge, brick fireplace, of course, and the rest of the building is a wooden building.
Is it dilapidated, or is it in pretty good shape?
It's in pretty good shape compared to some. Now, I've seen some in better shape, because I've slept in some where people use them as, you know, for current uses, guest houses. I slept in one about 2 weeks ago that has air conditioning, flat screen TV.
Oh, my.
I slept in one. The owner just took it off the market, and she was asking $600,000 for it. So these places exist everywhere.
So we need to make clear, these aren't all cabins in jeopardy of falling apart. Sometimes they're part of a larger, maybe a plantation house or something like that.
Yeah, they exist in many forms. We obviously look for the plantations and those cabins that exist on plantations, but we also must take into account the urban slavery that existed. And when we do that, the numbers just tend to multiply of places where slaves once stayed. We also have to take into account, you know, northern states. A lot of people tend to think that slavery existed only in southern states, but when we factor in those northern states, again, the number of places that still exist tend to multiply also.
But in the South, it's more apt to be a cabin-type situation as opposed to inside an actual house, correct?
Yes,
yeah.
You are correct.
Okay. Is it known how many former slave dwellings are in jeopardy of being demolished or falling into serious disrepair?
Well, I think more are saved. I've come across an equal number of those that are saved versus those that need some serious work done. I know of many that, you know, may not last through the end of the year if they aren't at least stabilized. And that's why the project now, the Slave Dwelling Project, is transitioning from just, you know, sleeping in these places and bringing awareness to them to being more proactive, being more in a position where some funding can be identified and used for stabilizing of some of these places, because once they're stabilized, we can develop the support groups around these places to take them to that next level of restoration.
I pointed out in the introduction here that you do work for the National Trust for Historic Preservation, but this initiative, the Slave Dwelling Project, is really your own thing. What led you to embark on this project?
It's a void in the buildings that we preserve. We tend to preserve those buildings that are more iconic, the more architecturally significant buildings, and there's nothing wrong with that. These places should be preserved, and we should talk about the heroes. But we tend to stop there. We tend not to look at the buildings that once housed African Americans as slaves, because that's a subject that in some circles are taboo. People are afraid to just go there. And when the buildings are gone, it makes it easier to deny the story. So it is my quest to identify those buildings that are there, ask the owners to spend the night in them. And most of these owners have been forthcoming. They know I come in peace. They know I'm not about, you know, reparations or looking for artifacts or looking for ghosts. It's all about the place and making sure the places continue to exist. And allowing the places to evolve also. A lot of folks have a problem with some of the uses of the places, but these places are private property. These owners should be allowed to do whatever with these properties that they so choose. My only desire is that they interpret the properties for what they actually are and were.
We're talking with Joe McGill. Joe is the director of an initiative called the Slave Dwelling Project. He has just spent the night in a former slave dwelling in Old St. Mary's, Maryland, and we're talking about his experience and his quest to preserve some of these slave dwellings. What goes through your head when you're in an old slave cabin and the lights are out and you're going to sleep? I mean, it must fill your head with you can't help but imagine what went on in the space that you are sleeping in.
Yes. Well, luckily for me last night, staying in the space with Terry Brock, the historian for this particular building, and him knowing the particulars of the building, I had all that time in that space to engage him in his knowledge of the building, and a lot of that happens now in the stays that I do, because very seldom do I sleep alone and in these places. now. People, they see the relevance of the project. They ask me to join me, and I seek permission from the owners, and I do that. So very seldom do I sleep alone. But the thoughts that go through my head is, you know, this was the one place that the people working on a particular plantation has some serenity within their lives, somewhat some control. But even that could be interrupted by the desire of their owners. A female, for instance, could be, you know, the victim or the desire of the owner or some of his sons. Or if indeed one of the males got out of line, you know, they could be subjected to some type of severe punishment.
Sure.
But within that space, you know, they had some type of control, very limited control. But and another thing was the fact that, you know, they spent very little time within that space. Most of their time would be off making that that plantation or that particular business that that owner was engaged in. Most of that time was spent doing that for that owner.
So in a way, as dilapidated as some of these accommodations are, it was actually a refuge, in a way, from the hard work that went on when they were not there.
That is correct. That was their space, their time to do just that.
Is this you alluded to fundraising a minute ago, Joe? Is this a fundraising exercise in the end? Do you have a dollar goal?
Well, what I'm going to do, we're transitioning right now. The project is we're achieving nonprofit status. I hope to have the paperwork to the federal government, along with that big check that's required to get the nonprofit, you know, 501c3 status. In the meantime, we're planning the first conference for the Slave Dwelling Project. It's going to be September 18th through the 20th in Savannah, Georgia. So I hope folks will mark their calendars for that. And when the website is up and running within a month or so, I'll be able to direct people on how they can become members of the organization.
Okay. So,
but the ultimate goal is, yes, to have that funding there necessary to at least stabilize building.
So if you were successful in your quest, in a few months, anybody who's interested could Google Slave Dwelling Project, and hopefully they would see a 501c3 or an option to get behind your cause if they were interested.
That is correct. Yes.
Okay, very good. Joe McGill, this has been very interesting. We appreciate your time. Joe's a program officer with the National Trust for Historic Preservation and is the driving force behind the Slave Dwelling Project. Joe, best of luck. Thanks.
You are welcome.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Many Michigan businesses have voiced concern and disapproval of the federal Affordable Care Act. Twice before on Current State, we've explored the issue with one of the state's key advocates for small business, Rob Fowler, CEO of the Small Business Association of Michigan here in Lansing. Last time on our show, Fowler explained two ways that he feels the ACA is hurting employment in Michigan. And he added that too little has been done to address escalating costs of health care, which he says is another drag on businesses. In the third and final segment of our interview, Rob Fowler first shares some thoughts on the health insurance exchanges that will be unveiled next week.
We talk a lot about exchanges, but there are two exchanges, one for individuals and one for businesses. It's called the shop exchange for businesses. I think there is value most likely to the consumer of the individual exchange. I actually find very little need. It's more of a solution without a problem, the small business exchange. Again, there is competition in the marketplace delivered through independent insurance agents at the table of a business owner. So transparency and competition, we have strong elements to that already. I don't know that it adds great value to that. And it does add cost. 3.5% of premium can be charged to run the exchange. It's going to add costs. From our perspective, it's not going to add a lot of value. And while I'd like to think that the exchanges have some place, the one potential value that it could have had, which is to allow an employer to have multiple vendors, that is, some of their employees could go with one insurance company, other employees could go to another insurance company, and yet another group could go to a third insurance company, and that would all come back to the employer in one bill. That part of it was also delayed. It was the first delay that was announced under the Affordable Care Act. So it's complicated. Our view has been the shop exchange, the small business exchange, probably is going to bring less value to the marketplace than the individual insurance exchange.
How many of your members are actually in the healthcare business or healthcare administration business, let's say? Is it significant to you? Is it noticeable to you?
Well, it's not a distinct voice in our membership. So, you know, that is to say, yes, I think we have a number of members who are in the food chain of healthcare in one way or another.
All right.
But the voice we hear is the employer perspective. And so whether you're in the health insurance business or the healthcare business in one way or another, or you're a manufacturer or service company, the perspective of employer and trying to provide health insurance to your employees affordably isn't distinct from one industry to another.
I'm curious, you alluded earlier to how many of your members already offer their employees health insurance. How many is that? What percentage of your membership offers that now?
Well, so we have nearly 21,000 members. A little over 4,000 of them provide health insurance through our plan. You know, it's interesting. So I said to you earlier, 50 employees or more, if you've got 50 employees or more, 92% or more provide health insurance already. But most companies, if you take all of the companies in the state of Michigan, over 90% of them have less than 50 employees. So the vast majority of companies are below 50 employees.
Okay.
Those are the ones less likely. About 36% of those companies provide health insurance to their employees today. That number used to be above 50 only 15 years ago. So that's the dramatic drop in health insurance in small businesses come from companies with fewer than 50 employees who just simply couldn't afford it anymore. To us, that's been the crisis that's led to our involvement in health insurance all along. It's the cost. It is unsustainable and unaffordable. So our voice in this whole discussion has always been about cost, and it's the issue. It doesn't matter. In some ways, it doesn't matter who's paying for it. If it can't be afforded, it can't be afforded, whether it's the individual, whether it's the employer, or whether it's the federal government. We simply can't afford it if it keeps growing as it is today.
There's a general election next year in the state. We'll be voting for a new governor, a new U.S. senator. Where's your head at on where the state is heading politically?
We do endorse candidates, at least we have historically, for governor, for House and Senate positions in particular, and we do that based upon their voting record for the most part. So if they support small business, we support them, and vice versa. For those who don't have a voting record, we do some pretty extensive surveying and all those sort of things. So we'll be doing that. The process will go forward. But it's been kind of interesting looking at where we've been over the last few years. I mean, the reality is some of our most important policy issues have been taken up. We hated the Michigan business tax. We hated its predecessor, the single business tax. From our perspective, we've done something that was illogical, and we've done it for many years. It was to double tax the income of small businesses. We did it routinely. You would basically pay a tax on whatever you brought into your company. You'd pay the corporate tax, and then whatever you was left over, you pay on again. Some states don't do that. And I mean, if we really want to be an entrepreneurial state, that is nonsensical. That is what got fixed in the Michigan business tax. Corporations pay taxes, business taxes, and small businesses who are pass-through entities, which an LLC, a sole proprietor, those kinds of companies pay taxes on their income but don't pay twice on it. And that to us was a huge policy issue that makes so much sense, and I believe it's one of the things driving this new growth in small business that we're seeing today. we made major changes in unemployment compensation and workers' compensation that got very little attention, but they were pretty dramatic changes. So state government doesn't have a magic bullet, and in many ways we give too much credit and too much blame to our governors and our legislatures. But for the levers they do have, for the things they can make a difference in, we believe they've really made some very positive changes over the last 3 or 4 years that are worth crowing about. And I think they're showing up in the data and they're showing up in the numbers. I'm really pleased at how we compete with other states today. So you ask, how's the direction? We think it's very positive. It's palpable when you get together with a bunch of small businesses today that they are optimistic, showing up in the data that their sales are up, their profits are up, and their employment is looking up as well.
Do you expect to endorse a Republican for the U.S. Senate for Michigan?
Actually, we don't endorse in the U.S. Senate race, nor in congressional races.
Why not?
Well, I think we don't really have a strong national advocacy agenda. Having said that, we work through our national association, but we don't have a list of federal issues that we really get involved in. We don't lobby our U.S. senators and our congressional delegation much, only as a part of a bigger voice with our national association. So I think we don't feel like we have the credibility, the voting record, if you will. So what we say to a House member or a state senator is, here are the issues that small business cares about, and we will judge you based upon how you vote on the issues that we care about. The way we say it is, we get to decide what's good for small business. We don't have a similar situation on federal policy, and therefore we really don't get involved in the U.S. Senate and U.S. House races.
Rob Fowler of the Small Business Association of Michigan talking about his response to the Federal Affordable Care Act. Michigan State football endured their first loss of the season in South Bend on Saturday, 17-13. The Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexrow joins us now for his take. Welcome back, Joe. Good to hear from you.
Well, thanks for having me back, Mark. Good to talk with you.
The Spartans were frustrated largely by penalties. How big a problem is that moving forward, do you think?
Well, I think the way Notre Dame attacked Michigan State is really not new. I mean, the way Michigan State plays defense, it does put its quarterbacks out there like that and sort of invites teams to try that. Those are low-percentage passes, and that's why Pat Narduzzi likes playing defense that way, and then he brings his safeties up to the line and gets more run support. But when you get that many penalty calls, then it doesn't matter if they're low-percentage. You know, and of course, penalties contributed to both the Notre Dame's touchdown drives. Moving forward, you know, I don't know that it'll have that much impact. I mean, I think every game's called differently. I think a couple of those calls were definitely good ones, and I think a couple of them were definitely bad ones. But, you know, I think Michigan State will keep playing defense. The bottom line is, even with all that, Michigan State gave up 17 points and had a great chance to win the game thanks to that defense.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, we lost by 4 points to a ranked team. Should Spartan fans feel more confident about the rest of the season after Saturday or less, or about the same?
Well, you know, I guess I could say more. I mean, look, Michigan State has certainly improved since the first couple games when things kind of looked bleak in those two ugly wins over Western Michigan and South Florida. But, you know, I think Saturday was kind of familiar. It was a lot like a lot of last year's losses, with great defense, a close game, and not quite enough offense to get over the hump and win the close game. And I think that's the concern, you know. And I think, well, of course, most of the attention, or a lot of the attention, the attention that's not on the officiating is on the coaching decisions to, you know, one, take Connor Cook out late in the game and sort of reopen the whole quarterback question, and then just, you know, The trick play, of course, certainly went wrong and sort of kind of changed the momentum of the game. At
that
the
time. Was really unpleasant to watch. MLive's Mike Griffin pinned the loss on the coaches for poor play calling and questionable personnel decisions. Does he have a case there?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people were critical of the coaches, and I think that's valid. You know, that play call, Michigan, it's 10-all, Michigan State's running the ball. And again, it's always easy to criticize play calls after the fact whenever they don't work. Had that play worked and gone for a touchdown, oh, what a brilliant call. But I even at the time when I saw it unfolding, I was very surprised, especially to see a freshman throwing the ball there. And yeah, I really think it was a mistake to pull Cook at the end. Clearly, it didn't work out. And again, if Maxwell leads him down the field, then they brought in the closer. And however things turn out, it's much easier to either criticize or praise. But I think that was a bad move for the long term, because now Cook's confidence is shaking a little bit, and there's uncertainty there. And this late in the season, you really can't have uncertainty at that position.
It's rarely a bad time for a week off, and MSU gets that this next weekend before we start the conference schedule against Iowa. What kind of matchup do you anticipate there?
Low-scoring defensive game. I think there'll be a lot of those this year in Iowa. Iowa would beat Western Michigan 59-3 last week, which looks awfully impressive, and was impressive, but it should be noted, 2 interception returns for touchdowns, 2 punt returns for touchdowns to kind of inflate the score. But Iowa struggles on offense and plays good defense, and the same with Michigan State, and I think it's going to be a grinder kind of game like it often is between Michigan State and Iowa, and I think it's absolutely the key game of this season. If Michigan State wins this game, it could very easily be 4-0 in October and be 7-1 taking on Michigan November 2nd. If it loses this game, you know, really you can pretty much look at that Big Ten Legends Division and say, Michigan State's not going to be able to survive that loss. And then, you know, things could unravel this season, really.
Joe Rexrode writes about Spartan football and basketball for the Detroit Free Press. Joe, we'll talk again soon.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we conclude our Detroit Water Renaissance series with a look at efforts to clean up the Rouge River. Also, we explore the history of capital punishment in Michigan. All that and more Tuesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. It's Current State on WKAR.